Hi, and welcome back to Undisclosed Unfiltered. Ravia here. I'm here with my colleagues, Colin and Meetal. Hey, guys, how you doing?
Doing well. How about you?
It's a whole different world than it was a week ago. And I'm really feeling like, you know, like maybe Susan Simpson and I need to restart our political podcast at this point. But yeah, it's been a week.
I've thought about that so many times.
Yeah, I have too, just to have an outlet. But I'm also a little congested, so if I sound a little off, sorry about that. I'm on the upswing, but, you know, there's all kinds of weird bugs going around. All right, so Colin, do you want to start off this today? Because there's some, like, is that what you're going to talk about, what you texted us about earlier today?
No, that was just what Meetal raised earlier, so I thought we'd revisit it before we get to our new topics for this week.
All right, well, then why don't we do that, Meetal? I'll turn it over to you. Why don't you give us an update? Is there an update on the Guthrie case?
I have two updates.
Okay, let's do it. Let's do the updates, and then we'll get to our stories.
Okay, so we'll start off with Nancy Guthrie. It's been a month since she's been taken, and still, unfortunately, no signs of where she might be or who might have her. You know, the latest from last week was that they were doing forensic genealogy, but no results yet, no additional DNA, so still no suspect in custody. The authorities are returning Nancy's house back to the family because they're done. Mm. They don't need to seal it off anymore. And the one lead that is currently being investigated, which is, I feel like it's kind of been in the wind a little bit, is, so remember they were getting camera footage from, you know, the neighbors up to about 2 miles away. They did that. Nothing came of that. Well, recently they got some footage from somebody who lives 2.5 miles away. And that showed a dozen cars driving around in the neighborhood that morning.
A dozen cars?
A dozen cars, one of which was in front of her house around the time that her pacemaker stopped syncing with her cell phone. So we'll see what comes of that. I mean, no details around the cars, no make, model, color, nothing like that. But at least that's a lead that can be pursued, right? So
I think I misunderstood. I thought you meant like it was like a 12 cars kind of traveling together.
Yeah,
and
no,
all
no,
involved.
There were multiple cars. Yeah.
Oh,
multiple cars in and out.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, that's crazy.
Now not the one car going back and forth a dozen times. No.
No. But yeah. I guess what I'm trying to say is, of those dozen cars, I thought initially you meant all dozen are involved, but then it sounded like you meant of them, like there's 12 cars that this camera captured. One of them was in front of the house.
Right. One of them specifically, like at
so
at
we
the
don't
time
know how many are involved.
Exactly.
It could be more.
Exactly.
Got it.
Okay.
Is there a license plate number that the camera catches?
Nothing that has been communicated to the public.
Yeah.
I'm surprised it's taken this long to get that information.
And I remember like at least maybe the first weekend, I remember hearing about cars in the area. You know, but then that was kind of, I don't know, I guess they weren't ready or maybe they didn't have enough footage to really be able to talk about that more. So we'll see what comes of it.
Have they released footage of the cars?
Nope.
Okay.
Nope. And there's no other, you know, images of the suspect besides the one from the camera footage, from her doorbell camera footage. So
they're keeping it close to the chest right now.
Yeah.
I'm surprised they're not, unless, you know, I guess if they can't see anything identifiable, then maybe that's when they would take it to the public and say, can anybody recognize these right now? Maybe they're like, we don't need the public all over this because it'll just mess it up.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, you know, when Savannah posted about the additional $1 million reward from the family, they got 1,500 more calls. But again, still nothing. And I think more recently she posted again saying, hey, we'll give it to you in cash. You can remain anonymous. Like, just give us our mom back wherever she is, however she is. So, yeah. That's it.
Okay. It's progress, though.
Yeah. The other update I have, also from last week, is the Colin Gray trial that we were talking about. Colin Gray is the father of Colt Gray, the 14-year-old that shot and killed 4 people and injured 9 at his school. The father's on trial because he was charged, you know, with multiple counts, including 2 counts of second-degree murder, 2 counts of involuntary manslaughter, and a bunch of other things. Well, just before we started this recording on Tuesday, we got an update, and It's done. 2 hours of deliberations. The jury found him
Whoa.
guilty on all 27 charges. He's going to jail.
2 hours of
That's
deliberation.
it. Yeah. And, they polled the jurors, all guilty. So sentencing's been deferred to a later date. So I don't know if he's going to get.
And can you remind us of like the kind of charges we're talking about? Like it includes like murder charges,
Yeah. So
right?
2 counts of second degree murder, 2 counts of involuntary manslaughter, cruelty to children. I think there's 20 counts of that, multiple counts of reckless conduct. So
Yeah.
multiple.
Yeah, I think the big thing that I saw was they had a digital forensics expert testifying for the state, and they detailed months of red flags in the son, and the father still giving him guns and accessories. And I think from what I saw, among everything else, you think about a case of how horrible for this parent who's in the dark and their child commits this terrible crime. I think this digital forensics expert really filled in that blank and said, look, this was not a case of being in the dark. There are all these red flags that a reasonable person would have seen and not given their child's firearms and accessories.
No, I was going to say, actually, his ex-wife and daughter also testified against him. And the daughter said, I feel
Really?
I'm happier being, in custody. Like, that's crazy. And
What do you mean? What do you mean she's happier that he's in custody?
no, because she's, CPS took her away from that, from the family, right? So, yeah.
Being in CPS custody. I was confused. Okay. Did he testify? Do you know? Do we know? Do
I
you know?
don't think so. I don't remember.
How long did the trial last?
I don't think it was more than like 10 days. I want I,
Yeah, because I thought last time we talked about it hadn't gone to trial
No,
yet.
it had
So I'm
just
sorry, I didn't
started.
know that.
Yeah, it had just started.
Oh, it had just
Yeah.
started. Okay.
So it was under 2 weeks.
Okay,
Yeah.
wow.
Well, I mean, the fact that the trial was under 2 weeks and then deliberations just for 2 hours. So,
Yeah.
but
Well, Colin, what do you think about this ruling? Like about the precedent in a sense?
I mean, that's sort of what I was raising there, where, I don't want this to open the doors to parents being prosecuted for serious crimes when they've done the best they could parenting, and there's this horrible tragedy, and we can't control it. And that's where I think that this expert coming in and showing, look, here are all the red flags, and this is something where a reasonable parent would not have given guns, let alone just allowed this to fester. And so, I'm hopeful that this is a limited ruling that will apply in similar cases where parents are arguably facilitating a crime despite seeing clear red flags and is not used to prosecute parents who are doing the best they can and their child does some horrible act.
Oh, boy. I don't know about you, but I like keeping my money where I can see it. Unfortunately, traditional big wireless carriers also seem to like keeping my money too. After years, I mean decades of overpaying for wireless, I finally got fed up with crazy high wireless bills, bogus fees, and quote, free perks that actually end up costing more in the long run. And I switched to Mint Mobile. Mint Mobile is here to rescue you, and they rescued me with premium wireless plans starting at only $15 a month. Imagine how much you could save if your wireless plan only cost $15 a month. I ended up saving over $100 a month, and every one of their plans comes with high-speed data, unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. You can bring your own phone and number, you can activate with an eSIM in minutes, and start saving immediately. Also, Mint Mobile has no long-term contracts, so there's no hassle and you're not stuck. Ditch overpriced wireless and get 3 months of premium wireless service from Mint Mobile for $15 a month. Think about what you could do with those extra savings every single month. I love using Mint Mobile. I've got my kids on the plan, and I love my money. So if you like your money too, Mint Mobile is for you. Shop plans at mintmobile.com/undisclosed. That's mintmobile.com/undisclosed. Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month 5-gigabyte plan required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customer offer for first 3 months only, and then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See Mint Mobile for details. All right. Should I take the next one, or Colin, you want to take the next one?
Whatever you want.
All right. Why don't you go?
Okay. So in the United States, we have the Sixth Amendment, and one of the protections is against double jeopardy. You can't twice be prosecuted for the same crime. If you're found not guilty at a first trial, you can't be prosecuted again. This goes all the way back to England before the founding of this country. It is this well-established protection we have against being prosecuted twice. That said, if we go back to England, in 2003, they pass a law which carves out an exception to double jeopardy. And it says, one, if there's fresh and compelling evidence of guilt, and two, a re-prosecution would be in the interest of justice, we can have a second prosecution of a person who is found not guilty at a first trial. Eventually, 2006, 2007, some states in Australia decide we're going to have a similar exception to double jeopardy. Over the past couple decades, there's only been one case out of Queensland, Australia, where they attempted to re-prosecute, and that was eventually dismissed. That takes us to now, I think last week, and this is very clandestine because they don't want to reveal until the judges rule, but now this could be the first time where a man is re-prosecuted after being found not guilty. And so there's not many details, but this was a murder, and he allegedly committed this with another man in 2009. He's found not guilty. He then says, I find Jesus. You know, I might come to Jesus moment, I turn to religion, and I realize I need to confess that I took part in this murder. He goes to the police station and he gives two confessions, including at least one that is recorded.
Wow.
So the prosecutor in Australia says, okay, this meets the exception to double jeopardy. We can re-prosecute him. Despite the initial confession, the man's attorney is now saying his confession is not reliable. He can't be re-prosecuted. He argues specifically this man had given two different versions of the events to his wife and the police. What he confessed to contradicted some of the crime scene evidence. And so, you know, I raised this with my students in my wrongful convictions class. And so here's what I kind of posed to them, and I'll ask the same thing to you, which is to say, a person is found guilty of a crime, a rape. DNA testing years later can prove their innocence. Person is found guilty of a murder. Someone else confesses, even though there's a lot of red tape, that can lead to their conviction being thrown out. Does that mean what Australia and certain states in England has done made sense? Person is found not guilty. We have DNA testing. It proves they, in fact, are guilty, or they're found not guilty. They confess to the crime. Should we have an exception to double jeopardy here in the U.S. if there is this new compelling evidence and it's the interest of justice? Or should we keep the status quo? And if you've been found not guilty once, we don't care what the circumstances are. You can never be prosecuted for that crime again.
Well, first, I have a question about this particular case, and I'll tell you what I think about your hypothetical.
Yeah.
But after this man made these confessions, he then lawyered up and said, I take him back. Is that what
Correct.
Happened?
Okay. Exactly.
Okay. Yeah, I don't agree that there should be exceptions to the double jeopardy rule, because I feel like that leaves open the possibility of, I mean, we have come across enough detectives in yeah. our work who can't let shit go, and they will continue to try to find evidence, make up evidence, plant evidence. Like, you know, I'm like, I feel like don't take your case to court until you have strong, you know what I mean? Until it is as made as it possibly can for the state. I don't think the state should be getting second bites at the apple, even if it means a guilty person gets away. That's how I feel about it. I just think it's too dangerous. It just keeps it open forever. I mean, you know, yeah. What about you, Mikko?
I don't know. I mean, I 100% agree with what you just said, but I'm just thinking what, you know, as much as technology advances and things like that, what if in the same way that you can prove by testing somebody's DNA, like if some other way you can prove what this person is saying and it validates, you know, their innocence or guilt. I don't think that'll happen as often, right? Like, I think the bigger risk is messing with evidence and, you know, trying to screw somebody over, essentially, the way that they currently do. Yeah, I think it's safer to stick to the way that it is right now with double jeopardy.
Yeah, and I was wondering, you know, Ravya, I had kind of the same thought as you going in, and then I realized, well, this has been in place in Queensland and Australia since 2006, 2007. This is the second time they've tried it, and the first time didn't work. But then I'm thinking, to your point, some of the prosecutors and cold case teams here in the US versus in Australia, it's kind of a Pandora's box, and I can see the logic behind it, but I'm just worried that this would open the door to all sorts of wrongful convictions.
Yeah. I mean, wrongful convictions are just, I mean, like, unethical conduct. I mean, you know, if you're able to convict somebody who is factually guilty, but you use unethical means, that's also not okay. Right. Yeah. Like, so that's the whole point of due process. And I feel like when it comes to double jeopardy, that's something that the criminal legal system got right a long time ago.
And I also think it's just, you know, the state of mind and the state of peace of someone who's been acquitted by a jury, right?
Yeah.
If we had this exception, you're found not guilty by a jury. Well, look, you never know.
Yeah.
Prosecution could come forward a decade later, 2 decades later, and say, we have this new evidence and try to take it back to trial. You're not going to feel that peace you should feel after being acquitted.
Yeah. I mean, like, they should not be taking, you know, look, the prosecutor should never be taking their case to trial unless they have enough to convict. That's what I think anyways. Like, you know, I imagine, like, I mean, like, you know, they could be like, oh, we just found a new witness out of nowhere, like somebody this guy had a beef with. I don't know. I just don't trust it. Yeah, I just, yeah. All right. Actually, so before I get into, well, what did your students think, Colin? I'm curious.
It was interesting because I think the majority were against it. Those in favor distinguish DNA from things like a confession or this new witness coming forward.
There have been some issues with.
Yes, I mean, there's some issues with DNA testing and some of the new, you know, variants, like the true allele testing. But that was kind of the point they made. If there's something objective, concrete, a video surfaces of the actual murder, that's different than relying upon what someone said. So there was the students who supported a carve out were still saying it should be a very limited carve-out.
I agree with that.
Oh,
yeah.
Actually, that makes a little more sense to me.
Yeah. Yeah,
that makes a little more sense to me, but. Yeah, that's a whole lot of litigating about like what those carve outs do. It would just I don't know. Yeah, I would leave the door open. But before we get into the story, I wanted to talk about though, Colin. I feel like created a little bit of a ruckus with our latest episode. We had on CC Williams to talk about. I can't remember the name of the case now. Sorry, but we had CC Williams on this week to talk about the case in which there was the vehicular accident or murder of the killing of these two children. What's the name of the lady involved? Huh?
CC Woods.
I said CC Williams. Wow. I should have brushed up before I got on. Anyway, I'm chalking it up to the meds I'm on right now. It's CC Woods was a journalist, but she was on to talk about this case. Anyhow, we've got a couple of comments and I thought it'd be a good idea just to kind of respond to them. I'm guessing a lot of folks probably felt the same way as I did when I learned that Cece was in fact had been paid by the family of the defendant to like write about the case. One of them is from Heather. Heather says, literally could not listen to the interview. In the first 5 minutes, Cece Woods laid out so much false information. It's unbelievable. She's been paid by it was Rebecca Grossman. Grossman's to flip the narrative. I only listened 5 minutes. For starters, Rebecca is absolutely a socialite. She may also be a philanthropist, but she's definitely a socialite. She goes on. She also says she lives in that canyon where Cece had talked about. She's like, it's a canyon road. And according to Heather, she's like, It is a 45-mile-an-hour street with neighborhoods on both sides of it for the entire length of it. It is absolutely a neighborhood street. I live there. I drive it every single day. The kids were crossing in a crosswalk from their neighborhood across the street to where there's a man-made lake with neighborhoods surrounding the lake. I'm not going to listen to the rest of the episode because I literally can't stand it. All anyone wants is for Rebecca to take responsibility for what she did. The front of her car was smashed and covered in blood. She absolutely hit those boys. And making up some ridiculous story about the other guy being the one that hit the kids is diabolical. Okay, Colin, what do you think?
Well, you know, what was interesting is, you know, we texted about this ahead of the interview, Rabia. And what I was saying ahead of time was, look, it might very well be that Scott Erickson was the lead vehicle and the first to hit the kids, but it certainly looks like Rebecca Grossman was also driving recklessly and hit the kids. And listener there was talking at the beginning of the interview, but eventually when we get into later in the interview, Cece was kind of agreeing and saying, look, even if Rebecca's not the lead vehicle, she was driving too closely behind Scott Erickson. I just think it should be involuntary manslaughter as opposed to murder. And so I felt overall comfortable with the interview because she wasn't saying that Rebecca Grossman is innocent. She was just saying, I think she was the second vehicle to hit the kids and it's manslaughter as opposed to murder. And that's kind of going into the interview after my own research where I came down on the case. And so, you know, I think anyone listening to that interview we had, it was a little bit tough to keep Cece exactly where we wanted her in answering the questions, and she did sort of go off in some tangents. But I think in the end, it kind of landed where I thought it should be going into the interview.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, look, and there were moments in the interview where, look, and I'm not that familiar with Cece's work and career in general. There were moments when I felt like I was a little surprised by some of the things she was saying, like when she started talking about, like, the, I guess, the DA being, or the ADA being, like, you know, like, woke and going after white people. I don't even know who that the prosecutor is. And but it just so happens that both the people involved in this, you know, likely Eric was also involved, happen to be white. So it's not like this person had a choice as to go after a person of color or a white person. In this case, they're both white. But yeah, Heather, if you're listening, if you continue to listen, you'd have seen that, in fact, Cece does, despite being paid by the family to have written these articles and you know, and reporting on the case, agrees that there is culpability, that Rebecca does have culpability. On the issue of the socialite versus philanthropist, I thought that was, I know that really irked you, Heather, but I think every philanthropist I know, and I know actually quite many of them, happens to also be a socialite. It's like part of the work, even though not every socialite is a philanthropist. And I think I understand this is about kind of rebranding Rebecca and making sure there's a lot of negative media and maybe adding some balance that she's also, along with being a socialite, is also a philanthropist. And I think both can be true. But also neither of them matter in terms of the facts of the case, frankly. And I think I did think she made valid points in terms of, like, there being a failure to investigate the other guy, right, Colin?
Yeah, and I think that's what it comes down to. And that's also kind of the point we landed on, which is that the witnesses who observed the crash said they heard these two distinct collisions like 3 to 5 seconds apart. And I think all of that supports two vehicles hit those children. One belonged to Scott Erickson, one belonged to Rebecca Grossman. And so for me, the story is more about how did Scott Erickson avoid any criminal culpability as opposed to why was Rebecca Grossman prosecuted? Now, again, the degree of crime might vary. But yeah, that for me, the big story was Scott Erickson not facing the music on this.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to move on now to the story. And there were just so many stories I wanted to talk about in the past week. But this one has been haunting me since I heard about it. It starts back in about a year ago on February 15th, 2025. And this happens in Buffalo, New York, on that morning. And, you know, it's a cold winter morning. It's a Saturday. This man named Nurul Shah Alam leaves his home and wants to go for a walk. It's been like him and his family, his wife and two sons, they had come to Buffalo as refugees just weeks earlier, okay? Or actually, maybe it was like 6 weeks earlier. They were in the country legally. They were Burmese Rohingya refugees. If you're not familiar with who the Rohingya are, you can look it up. Rohingya have been there's they've been refugees really even in their own countries for a long time. They've been exiled and kind of stateless in a way. So anyhow, they arrived in December 2024. So one on February 15th, 2025, the sun comes out and Shah Alam decides, I want to go for a walk. Well, here's the thing. Shah Alam is nearly blind. Okay. He did not have a walking stick and he needed one. So he leaves and he has with 20 bucks, he goes to a store near his house and he gets a curtain rod, or he buys one or two curtain rods. And he, you know how the curtain rods will come together and you can pull them apart. Mm-hmm. So you got two rods. So he's got two rods. But the man is nearly blind and his English is severely limited. Okay. He starts walking home, but he gets lost. And around 10:30 a.m., so it's early in the morning, he wanders into somebody's backyard. And that person calls the police and says, listen, this guy's, and I can understand this woman being like, what's going on? This guy opened up her back gate. He let her dog out of the backyard, and he damaged her shed door because he's like swinging his rods back and forth, right? So the police show up, and this is like in full force. We're not talking about one officer, two officers. We're talking about, like, at least from the video, look like half a dozen officers. And the police are like, well, and the body cam footage, by the way, is available online. You can look it up. And you can see Shah Alam swinging the sticks back and forth, and he's not touching anything. So I think he can't figure out, he's completely disoriented, you can tell. And he doesn't understand English. So the police keep telling him to drop his weapons, and he keeps saying, okay, okay, okay. He has no idea what's really happening. I don't even think he understands the police are talking to him. There's also a dog barking. There's like a lot of noise and he's disoriented. He doesn't know where he is. So then you see in the video that, you know, he keeps walking towards the voices, but swinging his sticks. Maybe, I don't know, because he's thinking like that's the way he's trying to navigate. So in making sure he doesn't hit anybody, or maybe he's trying to actually hit something solid so he knows where he is. I don't know. But clearly he doesn't have a gun in his hand. They are two flimsy curtain rods. And if you look at a picture of him, you can just tell from the picture that he likely is can't see, that he does not have vision. So I don't know. The cops are terrified. I mean, it's crazy to hear like the terror in their voice. They pull their, you know, weapons and stuff, and you know, they tase him, right? They tase him and then they jump him, and you know, there's like a number of them on top of him. They punch him in the head. They call him a fucking asshole. They're cussing at him. And at some point, you know, and you hear him say over, it's heartbreaking, like over and over again, he's praying over and over again. He keeps praying and praying. He's saying these words in Arabic, and I understand them. And they just don't stop. Anyhow, it's so clear that this man does not know anything that's going on. And at some point, he even says, I can't breathe. And officer says, take a breath, you're okay. Anyhow, they all finally calm down. And they take him into custody. He is charged with assault, trespass, and possession of a weapon, meaning the curtain rods. He's booked into the county jail, and he's eventually taken into federal custody. He actually pleads guilty. He pleads to two charges, trespassing and misdemeanor possession of a weapon. And but these charges, and you know, when you have immigrants, if you're here on an immigrant visa before you become a citizen, even when you're a permanent resident and you are convicted of crimes, certain crimes can make you removable. These were not crimes that would make him removable. Okay. So since last February, he was in custody. He's been in custody. Then what happened was either ICE or Border Patrol put a detainer on him, and there's some back and forth about who did, because they're close enough to the border that the Border Patrol CBP would be operating in the area. But the sheriff's office said the Border Patrol had said that, you know, we are going to take custody of him when he's released. And that's usually what happens. It's called an immigration detainer in these cases. Once an immigrant who's charged with crimes and serves out their sentence gets an immigration detainer, then they're transferred into immigration custody. So he's transferred to immigration custody. That happened 2 weeks ago. It's been about 10 days now. It was like 4:30 p.m. on a Thursday. The family does not know that he's been transferred. The family was told that when he's ready to go, we'll let you know and you can come pick him up from the Immigration Detention Center. Well, they know he's been transferred. They don't know that they determined that he's in fact not removable. These charges don't mean that we can deport him. So what they decide to do, instead of calling the family and saying, come, I mean, the guy has been in your custody. You know that he's disabled. He's visually disabled and visually impaired. They say to him, well, we're going to let you go, but we can give you a courtesy ride. Like, you know, instead of calling the family, we're going to give you a ride. Is that okay? And he says, okay, give me a ride. He's probably thinking they're going to give him a ride home. They know where he lives.
Right.
But instead, what they do is they take him to a Tim Hortons, which is many miles away from his house, and it's closed, okay? And the Tim Hortons closes like around 7 or 8 p.m., so it's nighttime, it's dark. They drop this blind man off at a closed Tim Hortons. It is like 35 degrees outside, and they leave him. He doesn't have a cell phone, he has no way to communicate, and they just leave him there. Now, there's like some video footage, and it shows like it shows him walking past the store and like just kind of wandering because he doesn't know where he is. And then at 8:30 that evening, there's somebody calls 911 and says that there's this unresponsive man wearing a dark parka and khaki pants who's not breathing. Who's completely unresponsive. She calls at 8:30. However, she had seen him earlier. She had seen him a few hours earlier, also laying on the ground. But she said at that time she initially saw him, his hands were gray. He's laying on the ground in the cold. But she doesn't call 911 because she saw that he's still kind of moving. When she passes by a few hours later, she's like, oh, he's actually not moving anymore. Then she calls 911. And when they got there, they found that he had passed away. Now, the cause of death there's a couple different reports. One report says the cause of death has not been made public. Another report said that the medical examiner has said that it was health related, which is super vague, but also I think that's not specific enough, you know. But he was also found 6 miles away from the coffee shop, by the way.
Oh, wow.
So that's how far he wandered before he finally collapsed. And, you know, at this point, obviously, there's just so many layers of horror to this story. This man already was a refugee. If you really do look up Rohingyas and their living conditions and how they've been persecuted in Burma for decades, for him to have made it to the U.S. as a refugee, it probably took him 10 years to do that to begin with his family. He'd only been here like less than 2 months, and then just everything that happened. The whole thing is so heartbreaking. The governor of New York is like, we're going to investigate. The mayor's outraged, all this stuff. But, you know, this begs a question that comes up over and over again for us is kind of like, what's the duty of care? What is the duty that, like, federal law enforcement owes? Because CBP is federal law enforcement, right? Mm-hmm. Like, what's the duty about, like, this woman who walked by, this pedestrian walked by and saw him just laying there in the cold. I mean, maybe call 911 and say this person, just call 911 and say this person might go need to go to the emergency room because it's dark at 5:30,
yeah.
6 right. o'clock. Anyhow, so did you guys hear about this case at all?
I hadn't. Robbie, my question is, not that it changes things hugely, but for listeners who don't know, Tim Hortons is kind of like Canada's Dunkin' Donuts, and it's, you know, coffee and donuts. And what I'm wondering is, did the officers say we thought the Tim Hortons was still open at this hour? Or did they say why they dropped him off at this Tim Hortons?
They said that the spokesperson said that that Tim Hortons was, quote, determined to be a warm, safe location near his last known address. But why didn't you take him to his last known address?
That's what I was going to say.
But couldn't you tell when you drive there that it's not open? Like, there's no lights on, presumably, or I mean,
I mean, is... apparently the shop was closed, but they, according to them, they said they saw lights on in the drive-thru. But it, the man's visually impaired.
Right. Make sure he gets inside. If you're gonna do that, not take him home, which I don't know you would do, but like, make sure he gets inside the Tim Hortons.
But yeah, like, why wouldn't you at least notify the family that we, by the way, we dropped him off here.
Right.
And also, this is another thing they said. They said, quote, he accepted a courtesy ride to the shop, probably because he had no idea what they're telling him. He probably thought they're going to take me home, and said, quote, he had no signs of distress, mobility issues, or disabilities requiring special assistance. Just go look at his picture and go look at that video and tell me if that's even possible. It is just an incredible act of cruelty. And when it comes to federal law enforcement, by the way, there is a duty here. There is a duty. Mm-hmm. There's a liability that arises if a certain relationship is created, such as when an officer takes a person into custody. Right. But the question here, I guess, for you, Colin, I guess, would be, would they say then, well, he's not in our custody anymore. We left him somewhere safe.
Except they didn't, right? So, I mean, that would seem to be the issue of, he was in your custody, you know he's visually impaired, and you didn't check to ensure that this Tim Hortons was open, and so you left him outside, legally blind, without a way for him to get to safety. And so I think that would be the argument that any plaintiff's attorney would make here.
I mean, I'm sure a lawsuit will be forthcoming. Mm-hmm.
And they'll claim qualified immunity, and that'll have to be something that has to be litigated,
Yeah. And, but, you know, the fact that he wandered like 6 miles away from the store is so heartbreaking to me. It's so heartbreaking.
Well, and looking at his picture in the video, he's not threatening looking at all. So what was the need for them to just pounce on him the way that they did and you know, beat him and things like that? Like, it just, it didn't make any sense.
Yeah. Do you know, like, Robbie, you mentioned, like, he pleaded guilty to a weapons possession charge.
He did. Referring
is that
to the
from the
curtain rod. The curtain rod. Yeah.
They're deeming the curtain rod to be a weapon.
Yep, he did. Trespassing and misdemeanor possession of a weapon. Because he was swinging the rods around. I also want to have a talk with his defense counsel and be like, really? Really? You didn't take that to trial? You took the plea? But, you know, people have different, like, you know, capability. You know, but look, I know way too many defense counsel who just talk their clients into taking pleas when I just feel like this is not a case. But it could have been very costly, right? Could have been very costly for them to go to trial. So I don't know. It's an awful case. If you guys want to look it up, his first name is Nurul. It's Nurul. And last name is Alam, Alam. And you can find the video on YouTube. You can see his picture. It's and there's been a lot of media coverage of it. Yeah. So, well, that's what I have for this week. And hopefully we will still be around a week from now to keep reporting on the terrible things happening in this country. I don't know. I'm like, World War III is upon us. Where do we flee? That's really the question for me. Am I the only one thinking about this, guys?
Uh-uh.
No?
I have planned.
Colin, where are you going to flee?
Yeah, let us know.
I mean, listen, it's you know, it's like I'm in War Games, you know, the movie from the 1980s with Matthew Broderick. It's just like, are things going to escalate, or is there going to be some way that we can find our way out of this and prevent what seems like this domino effect could happen?
Yeah. And, you know, as people are focused, by the way, what's happening with Iran, Pakistan and Afghanistan have launched a full-on war. Apparently India, the line of control between Pakistan and India is looking kind of hairy nowadays. So I'm like, well, there goes my plan B.
You need a plan B, C, D, and E.
Canada's so cold. I don't know where to go.
New Zealand.
Maybe South
New
America.
Zealand. That's the place to be. That's where I'm going to be.
It's going to be down there with the Kiwis. I love it.
Meet down in Wellington, yeah.
Yeah, we can still podcast from there.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Thank you so much. Thank you guys for tuning in. And, you know, make sure you send us your comments, messages. We do listen to them. Thank you, Heather, for your message as well. And we also hope, Heather, that you check back in and check out the rest of the episode. All right, guys. Have a good, safe week. We'll see you in 7 days.
Take care.
Hey, Undisclosed listeners. Before I roll through the credits, I've got a few quick notes. By now, most of you probably know about our Facebook community group. If you haven't joined yet, please go to facebook.com/groups toward justice and answer 3 simple questions and you're in. But seriously, answer the questions because a bunch of you are still pending since you've only answered 1 or 2. They're easy questions, I promise. In addition to engaging with us through the Facebook group, you can also leave us a voice note at speakpipe.com/undisclosed. We always check the messages, and so far, I think we've answered all of them. We also have a Patreon page with 3 different tiers of perks, the lowest one just being $1, which allows us to continue to do this work. Other tiers include bonus episodes, early access to merch, and even joining Rabia in a live true crime Zoom discussion. Just go to patreon.com/undisclosedpod. Now, onto the real credits. A huge shout out to Hannah McCarthy for audio production. Thank you to Patrick Cortez and Romero Marquez for our theme music. For anyone new here, you can engage with us online by going to Instagram or Facebook at Undisclosed Podcast. We're also on TikTok, YouTube, and X at Undisclosed Pod. Whether you're a new or returning listener, you can always check out our previous cases and bonus episodes by going to our website at undisclosedpod.com. If you would like to follow Colin and Rabia on social media, you can find Rabia at RabiaSquared2 on Instagram and Colin at EvidenceProf on Instagram, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you all for your continued support and for supporting all of our sponsors. Until next time.